I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. A century ago, only 1 in 10 people lived in cities. 100 years later, a majority of us call a city home. Darren Walker brings us a fascinating global perspective on the century of the city. That's the title of a new book from the Rockefeller Foundation that details strategies for creating livable cities in developing nations, as well as in the U.S. Fundamental to any city is its infrastructure. My guests, Michael Singer and Nancy Rutledge Connery, join us to talk about their recent publication, Infrastructure and Community, How We Can Live with What Sustains Us. Michael is a noted artist whose designs for big, complicated public works projects are as beautiful as they are functional. All that and our City Views commentator Walker Smith coming up on today's Smart City right after this news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Since 1913, the Rockefeller Foundation has been a pioneer in global philanthropy. My guest, Darren Walker, is overseeing the foundation's latest exploration, The Century of the City. It's an initiative that looks at the accelerating urban expansion that's happening right now worldwide. Darren, the Rockefeller Foundation has published a book, Century of the City, based on a series of discussions and research that you staged over the summer of 2007. What prompted you to bring people together around this topic?
What prompted us was the realization that we are at an important inflection point in global public policy as it relates to poverty. And the data that is quite overwhelming, and at this point, I think quite convincing, tells us that we are going to see a demographic tidal wave in urbanization and in population growth in cities and small towns across the world, but particularly in the developing world. And so, as we often do at the Rockefeller Foundation, when we think about significant global trends and challenges, we think about how we can help influence and impact how the world and key leaders look at these issues. And for us, our center at Bellagio, where we hosted these meetings, is a place where we convene and bring together people to think about the big problems of the day and to hopefully come up with some effective solutions.
Was your point of view that you're basically content to accept this inevitable move to cities and the inevitable rise in population of cities, or did you consider at all the possibility that that was a trend that you could reverse and that reversing it might be a good thing?
Well, first, let us embrace the notion of cities. And as we have in the developed world, we know that cities actually can mean opportunities for people and societies. So, no, we did not seek to think about ways in which we could reverse the trend of urbanization. We need to harness the trend of urbanization and the assets that urban people bring. And so, while we remain deeply committed and heavily invested in rural agricultural development, because we know that agricultural development will be key to the economic development of countries and regions, we also know at the same time that cities will continue to grow, that it is not really possible to significantly reverse the trends. And in fact, as we were told by one of the leaders in China, that was tried in China for over a decade to actually stymie the natural migration of rural people to urban areas, and it didn't work. And at this point, the Chinese have, in fact, now put in place a program that seeks to harness and to build upon the assets that people bring when they come to urban areas.
You essentially divided your inquiry into global cities, and then you looked briefly at U.S. cities. Let's talk first about global cities. As you say, people are moving so quickly to global cities that the growth has been difficult to manage. Can rapid population growth be managed so that these cities are really habitable?
I think it is certainly possible that population growth can be managed in cities. First, let's understand where the growth is coming from, because there is great variation in how this is happening depending upon region. A significant part of the growth is from traditional inward migration from rural areas to urban. The other is the fact that there is still a high birth rate. Fertility levels remain high in urban areas in the developing world and are projected to be relatively high. They have come down significantly since the 1950s. But when compared to the United States and the U.S., for example, they remain high, and they certainly will continue that trend. And so we know that it probably won't be possible or even desirable to reverse either of those trends. Now, I think as we think about global cities, it's also important to disaggregate the data. The data are quite clear about the global cities, the term global cities that Saskia Sassen created. And in that term, what Saskia was speaking to was the notion of these large mega cities, the cities that have populations of 5 to 10, even 20 million. Those cities are already on a trajectory. Those cities are connected in ways that really link them to a global economy, to a global industry of cities. There is another tier of cities that will never be global cities in that context. These are cities that are 500,000 to a million, and they are increasing in size and number all over the world. There is then a segment of cities that are really small towns, what we in America would think of as small towns. These tertiary cities, these cities that are on the outskirts of current fast-growing urban areas. Many of them, as recently as 5 years ago, were rural, were agricultural centers, and they now are becoming urban. So as we think about these global cities around the world, it's important that we understand that there is no one-size-fits-all, that depending on whether they are a very large city with a current infrastructure or they are a small city that has no infrastructure, the intervention will look different.
What are the biggest challenges these very large cities face?
I think the largest challenge is that there is very little planning in the traditional sense that we think of planning. And the planning that does exist is very haphazard. It's a huge issue. The infrastructure in many of these cities is simply at this point incapable of handling the number of people that are pouring into cities. And the intellectual infrastructure is simply insufficient. So in a city like Nairobi, which is seeing a tremendous population growth, there is a very small planning office. In most American cities or cities in the north, you have an urban planning office or a community development office, and there are many trained urban planners, designers, architects populating these offices. In the south, and certainly in a city like Nairobi, you have a small staff who are simply overwhelmed. And so we have to think about the capacity that needs to be brought to bear and actually to plan for and manage urban growth in the developing world.
And were I a planner in Nairobi, what would, besides feeling overwhelmed, what would be the real challenges I would be facing in terms of infrastructure, for instance? Are we talking about water, sewer, roads? I mean, what does it look like? Housing, I suppose?
Well, let's take Nairobi, because in many ways it's typical of large African cities. Within the Nairobi metropolitan area, let's talk about housing. There is different kinds of housing, and depending on the housing and its status, a different level of infrastructure that comes with it. So, for example, the largest housing segment in Nairobi are the slums. Kibera, Korogocho, these slums are characterized by a lack of basic water and sanitation. So there are not toilets. There is very little in terms of running water, although there are some interesting pilots going on for communal projects. Shelter itself is often 10 sheds that are 6 feet by 9 feet that house a family of six or eight. As you move into the city and you move to some of the more middle class and affluent areas, you in fact have an infrastructure that looks very much like the United States. Single family homes, detached and quite attractive with beautiful lush lawns and foliage and water to manage and sanitation and many of the accoutrements that we would see here in the United States. But what is not present in Nairobi is an overall system that brings together in a fair and equitable way housing, transportation. When we look at the transportation sector in Nairobi, you will see most people walk. People who don't walk, who may have access to one of the matutus, as they are called. These are the privately run van services. They're old VW vans that run on different routes, but they are for the most part privately run. And there are contracts with the city agency, but it's very uneven and there's great variation in terms of quality. Unfortunately, there are lots of traffic injuries as a result of the really poor transportation planning. So those are just two examples, housing and transportation, where local planning is woefully inadequate for the current population.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Darren Walker, Vice President of Foundation Initiatives for the Rockefeller Foundation. We're talking about the foundation's latest publication, Century of the City. You say in the book that action is needed urgently on climate change. Yet it doesn't feel, Darren, as if we're moving at any sort of urgent pace, certainly not here in the U.S. Why not, and what will it take to change that?
I think the challenge of climate change and cities is one of the most profound challenges that we face as a planet. And if you read the report, the IPCC report by its chairman R.K. Pachauri, who was, along with Al Gore, the winner of the Nobel Prize, the report basically says that we need to bring together traditional climate scientists and urban planners and urban professionals. When you look at the reports on climate that have been generated and that have been quite influential, rarely are the voices of the urban planning and urban professional design fields represented. It's mostly climate scientists and does not include a lot of people who need to be included. And so one of the things that needs to happen is we need to bring together the fields of meteorology and climate science with the fields of urban planning and design. And one of the things that we did at the Urban Summit in Bellagio was to actually bring together those two fields and to have people talk about climate change adaptation from an urban perspective. And we had some, I think, very, very rich discussions and some proposed solutions that we, in fact, are now trying out. We are testing and piloting in a select group of Asian cities. So we're looking forward over the next 3 to 4 years to piloting these projects and being able to report what we learn.
They always say that the future is with us. It's just unevenly distributed. Where do you see signs of the future at work in meeting the challenges that you described in the Century of the City?
I think we see the future at work in different cities. And so let's start with one that I would not have thought of 2 or 3 years ago, Durban, South Africa. In Durban, South Africa, which is a city that is with a very, very difficult history of racial strife and tension and is now coming to grips with a new generation of leaders, this city has embarked upon a comprehensive urban strategy that addresses climate change in a very serious and rational way with a quite compelling strategy for adapting to being on the coast, being a city with a very diverse topography, being a city with a very diverse background of people. So the climate change work that you're seeing in Durban is really the first generation of work that brings together both climate and urban planning professionals. One could look at a city like Rio, where you are seeing an extraordinary response to a very, very difficult crime situation. We know that when we have growth without real development, without real economic development, it could potentially portend huge social challenges. And in a city like Rio, we're seeing some of that. And the city itself has embarked upon a very, very compelling strategy of engaging with residents of the favelas to have them take more ownership and more control of the management of and the monitoring of their communities. It's very, very interesting and very much a pilot, a testing ground. Another very interesting laboratory, if you will, is Mumbai. Mumbai has a population now of over 15 million people. Its largest slum, Dharavi, which gained some notoriety because of the movie Slumdog Millionaire, is actually an extraordinary place. And when I was last there, I visited the headquarters of Slum Dwellers International, which is the network of slum dweller organizations, which in many ways are like American CDCs. These are local community-based groups who themselves have generated action plans for developing their slums. And they're actually quite proud to call their community slums. They don't see the word slum as a pejorative, and they are quite proud that they are slum dwellers, and they are quite proud of the progress they've made in developing these action plans. So, for example, they have come up with a plan for improving water and sanitation in Dharavi. They have built and managed hundreds of toilet facilities and wash facilities for slum residents. These are generating resources in a very sort of double bottom line way, a social benefit and a financial benefit. And it's actually empowering these organizations, the slum dweller organizations. And it's an indication of the capacity of these community-based efforts, just as we have seen in the United States with CDCs and other community-based organizations, a real capacity to have sustainable, enduring change. I think we're just starting to see the tip of that in the global arena.
You mentioned earlier that different size cities have different formulas for success. Closer to home, I want to ask you about America's mid-sized cities. In my view, they are particularly challenged as the benefits seem to be accruing to places that are larger, that have more opportunities, that have more talent. What is your view of America's mid-sized cities? Do you see them as particularly challenged, and do you see some unique path to success for those cities?
There is no doubt that America's smaller cities and medium-sized cities are vulnerable. They are vulnerable because they now must compete in a global economy. And no matter what has happened in the last few months to shake our faith in the idea of globalization or the momentum of globalization, it's very, very difficult to envision going back to a pre-globalization era. The technology is just there and is already being utilized and is irreversible, quite frankly. Having said that, I think we know that these same cities that are vulnerable actually have the assets, the basis, the foundation for real transformation. The key will be whether leaders in these cities can come together in innovative and fresh ways to create a new paradigm for these cities. And so the challenge, I believe, in these cities is old thinking. It's normative ideas and doing what we've always done. Because what we know is what we've always done is not going to be good enough in the 21st century. And so if there is one area I would say needs attention, it is the leadership of these cities. It is the leadership institutions that constitute the infrastructure in these cities. So if your universities, your mayors, your city councils, your hospitals are populated by people who just want to do it the way we've always done it, that's going to be a city in trouble. There is no amount of money, there is no amount of stimulus that is going to make it possible for those cities to be turned around if this fundamental issue is not addressed.
Mm-hmm. I noticed that as you begin to talk in Century of the City about America in 2050, a couple of things you talk about. One, you imagine this national planning framework and a national growth strategy. Are those politically saleable concepts?
There is no doubt that our federal system proposes many challenges for the United States to succeed in a global economy. And while I think I certainly am very proud of our American system, the fact that there is no national planning, that we as a country really leave to the states and localities to prioritize the planning objectives that really may or may not be what is needed most, there are real challenges. We as a nation seem to be comfortable with the idea that it's really up to the local community to decide whether excellence is going to be an objective for their community. And we see it in our public policy today. Within the United States, we have communities that by all indicators of human development, are third world. And we have communities that are beacons of exemplary best practice in everything they do. And so it does concern me when I think about what it will take to make this nation excellent, that there are some places that simply can opt out and can simply say, our state isn't going to be excellent. And that's a real problem in a world where, and a global economy where many of our competitors have set for themselves excellence as a goal and then put in place the process to achieve that excellence and the mechanisms to achieve it. And this isn't about resources. It's simply a fact that the kind of disparate, very atomized governance structure that we have in this country allows for there to be great variation in outcomes. And we're competing in a world where great variation in outcomes is not going to be tolerated by many nations, and they are planning in a way to make themselves excellent. And we've got to recognize that we've got to compete in that kind of global economy.
One more question, Darren. As a U.S.-based foundation that conducts its philanthropy worldwide, you can invest in anything. How do you make decisions about what matters, where the real levers are, and where you will invest?
Well, we are a U.S.-based foundation that invests internationally, first and foremost, because our donor, John D. Rockefeller, instructed us to seek to work on solving the problems of humankind all over the world. And so we have taken that mission and worked really at root cause issues. And we've focused on large, significant trends in a very futuristic way. The trend of urbanization has been with us, but only recently have the data been so convincing and compelling. And so with this evidence, we now know that this is going to be one of the mega trends of this century. And so for us, we simply cannot ignore this trend. As we do with all of our work, we're embracing it in a way to understand it, to think about how we can leverage it, to think about how we can adjust to it, but not simply react to it, but to think about in the future as these cities grow, what are the capacities, what are the resources, what are the infrastructure that's going to be needed to ensure that not more people, but actually fewer people are poor as a result of urbanization.
Darren, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
It's always great to talk to you, Carol.
Darren Walker is Vice President of Foundation Initiatives for the Rockefeller Foundation. He joined us from his office in New York. His interview was engineered by Amber Cortez. Coming up after the break, we'll find out how to make the Guggenheim of waste disposal. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta.
Hi, I'm Scotty Iseri, and if you're hearing my voice right now, it means you're listening to the podcast version of Smart City. And I have a message specifically for you, the podcast listener. We usually get a lot of really great comments via email from our listeners. They have questions about the show, things they heard, they have comments about things we got wrong or things we got right. Really intelligent input, and we thought, why don't we create a space online where our listeners can talk to each other? That's why we've created My City. My City is a social networking site for urban enthusiasts, people that love cities, people that want to see cities thrive, people that have ideas about making the next great city. So, how do you join? You send me an email. My personal email, I'm giving this out, Scotty, S-C-O-T-T-Y, at smartcityradio.com. Send me an email. I'll send you an invite. Join the conversation online. One more time, it's Scotty at smartcityradio.com. Thanks for listening.
I'm Carol Coletta. You're listening to Smart City. Michael Singer is an award-winning artist, and his body of work has transformed the development of public spaces. He's now turned his eye to improving public infrastructure. Nancy Rutledge Connery is an independent consultant on a wide range of infrastructure investment and community development issues. Together, they have created a publication about sustainable cities called Infrastructure and Community: How We Can Live with What Sustains Us. Throughout the discussion on the economic stimulus package, I noticed that any mention of new roads and bridges got a pass as good, while investments in education or the arts that would also create jobs were generally deemed as wasteful pork. Is all infrastructure created the same and of equal value?
No, it's not of equal value. There's lots of bits and pieces, you know, in this very complex system in America. Some of it is relatively new. A lot of it is old. We are only beginning to understand its value. The debate has only focused on filling the holes, getting the broken bits back up and running. But there's been very little emphasis on performance, about how this stuff works, the content. What is it going to do for the next generation of Americans? That's a very different question than just meeting the laundry list of failing infrastructure. It has to produce value, and that isn't the same as what the condition of it is in.
Nancy, you and Michael both have been thinking about next-generation infrastructure for our cities. What does that look like?
Beyond just the performance and the return on investment, we're also talking about questions of water quality and water conservation, energy efficiency, reducing greenhouse gases, more reliable services, neighborhood vitality, and all of those things are really part and parcel of the same question: what is good infrastructure? These elements all need to be part of the equation.
I would add that it's the new infrastructure has an opportunity to serve the communities in more than just their function, their specific function. So of power generation plant, by looking at its full systems, you can identify ways that that power plant can actually benefit the community surrounding it. The same is true for a waste transfer or a waste disposal. We call it integrated systems and whole systems thinking by looking at the way these facilities can interact and affect the places connected to them.
Michael, how did you get the people who are responsible for building infrastructure to think in a whole system sort of way?
What we really try to do is bring to the table, the design table, the planning table, right from the beginning, a wider range of professionals than would usually be there. We're looking at people who have the ability to address social issues in the community and how the infrastructure affects that. We're looking at people who are environmentalists. So, and it goes on. I mean, there's a list. There are designers, there are artists, there are social folks, there are historians. So right from the beginning, to bring a group like that to the table with the people that are making the decisions opens up the conversation to what's possible.
If I may add here, Carol, part of the motivation for thinking about new ways of thinking is because we really can't afford not to. You know, we can keep producing cars in the same old way, and we can keep producing infrastructure in the same old way, but I think it's become apparent that we can't afford to do that in environmental or economic terms. And ultimately, you know, the public has been a major barrier in some instances for infrastructure development or redevelopment because they are so angry at what is offered. So to the extent you can provide a package that actually produces the needed value, whether that service is, you know, water supply or waste treatment or power generation, but also provides amenities that are important to the community, does it in an environmentally sensitive way that actually repairs problems that are pre-existing, and without adding cost. I know that sounds like a tall order, but it can be done with a much more integrated approach, as Michael was saying, a whole systems approach. It starts to just sort of stretching our critical thinking caps to encompass the site as well as the context and not just the project itself by itself.
Nancy, are you seeing requests for proposals today for infrastructure that reflect whole systems thinking and using infrastructure to solve more than one problem at a time?
It's not a floodgate opening up yet, Carol, but we do see some encouraging signs. Even in the stimulus proposed projects, there were little nuggets that suggested that communities were thinking that way. Mostly we saw laundry lists, and that's been the characteristic of infrastructure in the past, you know, the long list of unmet needs, instead of looking at it a little more broadly. But I think it'll become clear $150 billion is no small change, but it just is a drop in the bucket. So if we're looking at really infrastructure renewal on a serious scale, you know, that's a major multiple every year. I don't think that kind of money is going to show up, but what money does show up, we hope will begin to include these new dimensions so that we can use it more effectively.
And we've seen from my studio, we looked at the list of projects that was produced by the mayor's conference from cities all over the country. And there are a number of cities that really stand out for asking for projects that specifically demonstrate environmental benefits and community benefits. I'll give you an example. One is in Albuquerque. They're asking for two very large solid waste transfer facilities for the city that specifically identify community opportunities for education and opportunities to generate energy from the facility. Things like that are very encouraging.
Along with LEED certification.
Yeah, right. Along with LEED certification, that the facility needs to have LEED certification. And then, of course, there are many projects that are listed from cities that are really repair projects. And they're looking at the past and fixing up problems from that perspective. And I you know, what's encouraging from my perspective is our work in Phoenix, the solid waste transfer recycling facility in Phoenix set a model, and that's already going back to 1993, a public works facility that really took as its main mission, aside from its function, educating and helping people understand the importance of recycling and creating an exciting place for the community, not just only the place to bring garbage.
And of course, that project is well renowned, as well it should be, but have many other cities attempted to do the same thing since that time?
Unfortunately not. I gave a talk in Providence about a year ago, Rhode Island, and people were saying when they saw the Phoenix Project and they understood, you know, what it was accomplishing beyond its main function of waste transfer and recycling, they just said, this is something that we should all be doing. Why is it 15 years old? This is really so much needed today. We need to see this more. You know, one of the reasons it may not be at the front line is because there's a misconception about costs. The Phoenix Project actually initiated with a bond for $18.5 million. It ended up being built with all of the added amenities, if you want to call them that, or added values, for $14 million. So there was a savings of $4.5 million on that project. And the question that I'm often asked is, well, what did this end up costing? Originally, when Phoenix opened, the press got a hold of it and called it the Taj Mahal of garbage, which I really loved. I thought that was a great comparison. But they, of course, were looking at it as though it was so expensive. And then when they found out that it was a tremendous savings, you know, they had to rethink that and rewrite it. Recently, a project for a marine transfer facility that we were working on with Environmental Defense Fund in New York City to help the mayor and the city council understand how a place like that could be sited in residential areas. When folks looked at the design, they called it the Guggenheim of garbage, which again was a great compliment to transform what is usually so ordinary and drab into something that people would identify as being very special.
I think it really depends upon visionary leadership from the elected officials or the appointed officials who understand why this matters. The public gets it pretty well when they see the opportunities, what they could having in lieu of the awful gray box behind the chain link fence with the razor wire on top. They are oftentimes very responsive, but it challenges a lot of the assumptions about the way these things should look and operate. And that's really what Michael's work has been about, is challenging assumptions right from the very start, and other designers too, because at that point you can begin to break it open. But it takes a courageous soul who's willing to buck the tide of convention that characterizes much of the public works industry.
Let's talk about the New York facilities that Michael brought up. One of the problems with big infrastructure projects, particularly solid waste facilities, is that no one wants to live next door to them. Michael, can we solve that problem with the Guggenheim of solid waste facilities?
That really was the challenge in the New York transfer facility issue. Environmental Defense did a very thorough and excellent study to show that moving waste through garbage trucks around the city and then transferring them up into the neighborhoods to the north of the city that were already economically, environmentally, and socially challenged just was putting not only an enormous amount of truck traffic on the road in mileage, it was also putting tremendous pressure and pollution into those communities. It had so many reasons why we should reopen or rebuild the facilities that used to be all along the water in the various districts of the city, so that a truck would pick up in your district and go directly to either the East River or the Hudson River to transfer the garbage into barges. So they were able, through reports and studies, to show the environmental impacts, health impacts, social economic impacts of maintaining that system. The one thing they couldn't demonstrate in that report was a vision that would allow a facility like that to be rebuilt or reopened in the most expensive property probably in the world. I mean, some of the most expensive property in the world on the riverfronts of Manhattan. And the challenge that they brought forth to us was, how, considering what we were able to do in Phoenix, how could we actually help people understand that a facility like this could be located in their neighborhood. So the first thing to do is really find out what people were objecting to when these facilities were operating. And the most objectionable issue was the queuing of trucks, the backing up of these garbage trucks through people's neighborhoods waiting to transfer was noxious and toxic and very, very disturbing. So one question was, how could we design a facility right off that would get the trucks off the road? Another was that a lot of the parking of these garbage trucks happened right on this very valuable property at the waterfront. How could we solve problems like that? Other issues were, you know, green space. How can we claim our riverfront for recreation and habitat and people having good park space along the river? And wouldn't facilities like this remove that opportunity? So the direction that we had really opened up those kinds of problems, opened up opportunity for design, as I think most designers would see. We were able to get the trucks off, and that's why it's called the Guggenheim of Garbage, because we identified with an engineer very clearly the turning radius of a garbage truck and a ramp system. And the ramp system allowed all the trucks to be in the facility and off the road. And so this is a large circular building that ramps similar to the Guggenheim, with a very large central space that the trucks are circulating around before they either enter the area where they tip their garbage or the area where they're leaving. So that central space allowed them to have parking inside the facility, an area where they could wash the trucks in the facility. It also provided area on the outside for a community activities room right on the river. The roof of the facility is planted, and it's planted with native vegetation that actually serves as parkland as well as habitat refuge for the birds that fly through that area. So the whole vision of this facility is much more than just the usual steel shed on the river with barges underneath and garbage trucks waiting to get in. When people saw that vision and what was possible, it gave Environmental Defense a lobbying tool to meet with the mayor and actually move forward in approving the new solid waste plan to rebuild these facilities all around the water.
Michael mentioned the Albuquerque projects in the stimulus package. Nancy, in the infrastructure arena, where is the most innovation taking place today?
I think the most exciting areas are the application of information and communication technologies, whether it's broadband or other forms of that, to existing infrastructure as a way of predicting problems long before they actually show up in clear terms, so that you can introduce intervention and solve something and keep either a bus or a facility running much more smoothly and use less energy in the process. It's the question of adding intelligence to everything we do, whether it's our roadway systems, both from the vantage of the drivers as well as from the vantage of the roadway itself, the condition of the road or the congestion issues, so that we begin to reduce those problems. And we begin to understand as consumers, like, for instance, we now are beginning to see programmable meters within homes about power usage, where you begin to understand how plug things in and how you operate your equipment makes a big difference on your bill. I think we'll begin to see those in the area of water and wastewater as well, so that we are much more aware as individuals, as consumers, as taxpayers, as members of society, to use what we have much more effectively. We're not going to be able to rebuild everything from scratch. We're going to have to really build into the existing stuff that we have as infrastructure more capacity to use it wisely. And that will be a work in progress, but there's lots of technology out there. And in fact, it's beginning to appear all over the world.
Nancy, two questions. One, if you're going to have the kind of multipurpose facility that Michael is describing, that almost assumes that one must have a team of collaborators from different disciplines and different departments in the client group, but collaboration is hard. People really just want to be left alone to do their own thing. So how do you make that collaboration easier for departments so they can use these facilities more efficiently and the infrastructure can be more productive?
That's a great question. It is hard. There's no question about it. Part of the problem in the past is that all of the incentives, financial incentives, you know, grants and funding sources tended to only reinforce the what we call the silos, you know, the tall silos, you know, that had just very, very narrow purposes. But I think the money is going to begin to broaden in the next few years. You're already seeing signs of that in the literature. So the financial incentives are one way. But the other part of it is going to be education processes. And I think there will have to be an ongoing effort to help communities understand how to break down those barriers. It isn't just political, it's also, or even operational. It's really cutting across to, geography and beginning to build solutions that, in fact, are going to be necessary because there's just no way we can support the old way of doing it. Now, again, it's going to take several years, but the models that have worked will serve as important guidelines for us. And, you know, the leadership of both public and private officials who see this as being valuable, they're doing this in other realms. You know, any major corporation is not just doing everything itself. It's bringing together a lot of different companies and you know, suppliers to produce an outcome, whether it's an airplane or an automobile or any other thing. And so, in effect, we're trying to do the same thing here. And there's technology that helps support that. But at the end of the day, it's personal commitment to sustainability, which I believe will become a much bigger issue as we begin to see the impacts of climate change and the energy problems and water shortages in various parts of the country. That is a huge galvanizer to help make this real.
What I've been seeing in relation to government departments and agencies in the South Florida area, and I think this is happening around the country, many cities have now identified green task force committees, which are often made up of citizens, but sometimes the green task force comes out of the interest within various city departments. And one of the key roles that I see for the green task force is in West Palm Beach. Mayor Lois Frank recently appointed an Office of Sustainability for the city. One of the key roles of that group is to be the communication network for the various departments within the city. They are still, you know, responsible and going to remain responsible for their realm of attention, what they need to be working on in each city. However, this office has an opportunity to check in and see where the projects are that could bring together folks in the planning department, folks in the public works and city engineering, folks in various development agencies, education of the city, even the arts, of course, and be that clearinghouse of communication and help move this kind of collaborative effort forward. I think if we depend on each agency to just, you know, be told you've got to collaborate, that's going to be problematic.
It's a pleasure to talk with both of you about the future of cities and the future of infrastructure. Thanks so much for joining us on Smart City.
Carol, it's a pleasure to talk to you, and I really respect and enjoy your program. Thank you.
Thank you, okay. Carol.
Michael Singer and Nancy Rutledge Connery are co-authors of the Environmental Defense Fund booklet, Infrastructure and Community, How We Can Live with What Sustains Us. And finally this week, the uncertain future of our neighborhoods, our nation, our jobs, and our planet can keep you up at night. But our City Views commentator Walker Smith has a few words of wisdom to keep you from going crazy with worry.
Back in December, when Atlanta had a long string of 75-degree days, I fretted about climate change nonstop. Every night, my wife and I would sleep with the windows open like we do from early spring to late summer, and I would drift off praying for the kind of cold weather we used to get in years past. I worried that this unseasonably warm weather was the harbinger of some abrupt transition in our global fortunes, and it made me pine for chillier days. What was I thinking? Late January came to Atlanta with day after day of temperatures in the teens and 20s. After about 2 weeks of that, I was more than ready for some 75-degree days again. It reminded me to be careful what I wish for, and it reminded me as well that sometimes there's just no telling what will happen. Maybe another stretch of unseasonably warm weather was on the way, but who knew? Indeed, who can really say for sure anymore? Lately, it seems like it's getting harder to know what to expect of the weather, or frankly, what to expect of almost everything. Today, we're in uncharted waters with the economy and our military and political positions around the world. Nothing like this has ever been seen before. Particularly for the economy, we can't say where we're going. Indeed, few economists foresaw the current conditions, so who knows if they have a reliable handle on tomorrow's conditions. This kind of ambiguity adds a huge dollop of uncertainty to the mix of what we're dealing with these days, which worsens an already tenuous situation. It makes my head spin, as I'm sure it does yours too. But there is one thing that keeps me from going crazy with worry, and that is that I know I can cope. I don't worry about the weather, because I know that whatever the weather, I can dress appropriately. I can cope with it. Similarly, I feel pretty confident that no matter what happens with the economy or with military and political conflicts around the world, we'll figure out an appropriate response. We'll know how to cope. We may not, indeed we do not, know enough to foresee what's coming. But we certainly do know enough to be able to respond in the proper way. We might not get it exactly right the first time out, as we've seen with the original financial bailout program, and it might take us a few tries to find the right answer, but doggedness will see us through. Maybe I'm being naive, but what gives me hope is not that we know enough to foretell exactly what's coming, but that we know enough to deal with whatever shows up. Pragmatism, not prophecy, is what we do best, and that's all it takes to prevail. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of the Yankelovich Monitor, a trend service of the Futures Company. He joins us each week from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. His latest book is Generation Ageless. There's more information about our guests and their work at our website, smartcityradio.com. You can also find links to our past shows, sign up for our newsletter, or subscribe to our podcast and have Smart City delivered right to you each week. You can also get in touch with us, click on the contact button, or send email to questions@smartcityradio.com and let us know how we're doing. Smart City's web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Scotty Iseri is our producer and engineer. It turns out he's really good at surfing. I'm Carol Coletta.